Hey, I'm Shimon, and this is the Faith Through Music podcast. Here we speak with artists, creators, and musicians about how faith influences their music and how music has influenced their faith. As a rabbinical student and concert photographer, music has played a key role in my religious experience. I believe that through these conversations, we will all be able to gain a deeper appreciation for the transformative power of music. Today I have the pleasure to speak with Rabbi Avraham Rosenblum. Rabbi Rosenblum is the godfather of Jewish rock, the founder of the Diaspora Yeshiva Band, the man who brought rock, bluegrass, and jazz to Jewish music, and the inspiration for generations of Jewish musicians. We discuss his early days in Philly and Greenwich Village, the creation of the band, his diverse musical influences, his personal religious journey, and so much more. Rabbi Rosenblum, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you. As a founder of such an influential band, where did your own passions for music begin?
I was always trying out for school shows, mm-hmm. I love to sing. My mom used to sing. She had a very nice voice. My dad, too. I think everybody in my family could sing and sounded very nice. And it was part of me. But then, when I had the opportunity to do a little bit of school show acting, even from the fourth grade and up. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky I got the lead parts because my voice was the loudest. not necessarily the most, melodious, but definitely the loudest. And a couple of years later was my bar mitzvah. So I wanted a guitar for my bar mitzvah because it was just around the time that folk music was making a big revival. Uh-huh. This is 1963. And there used to be a show on TV called Hootenanny. Uh-huh. And you know what a hootenanny is?
I'm from Atlanta, but it still doesn't ring a bell. So,
well, it's a term used for when folkies and bluegrass people get together, to jam, and it's called a hootenanny. It's probably an Appalachian term of some sort. But the guitar was gaining popularity, and as soon as I saw some of these folk singers playing guitars and banjos, and basses and things like that, I said, wow, that looks really nice. So one of the local Jewish community centers in Northeast Philly was having a Sunday hootenanny, for kids to come over and play instruments and sing. And, I went over to that. And, I met another guy named Paul, who we're still friends to this day, Paul Feldman. And he taught me my first couple of chords. And, took it from there. We had our first little bands when we were like 13, 14 years old, 15 years old. And, I just kept moving with it. I was a very serious guitar player. I everywhere I went, the guitar, went with me. Uh-huh. And I was, I was playing hours and hours and hours a day. Along the way, so then as, I got a little bit older, and then when I was like 16, 17, 18, I started playing with some good bands in downtown Philadelphia. Uh-huh. And it was cool. I was writing my own stuff. I was meeting other young people. Of every shape and kind, so to speak,
Yeah. What was that Philly music scene like in that time?
Well, it was a very hippie scene in Philly in 1967, 8, 69, 70. So 70, by 71, I left for Israel in January of 71. But, it was a big music hippie scene, a lot of little, funky stores, and shops that were taken over by hippie carpenters and things. So it was, flower power in its, in its prime, as we say. And it was a lot of fun. There were the little clubs and underground buildings. And uh-huh. And there was an old movie theater that was revived by a theater company on South Street in Philly known as TLA. It's, eventually it became a big rock center. For rock concerts, but TLA was just an old burnt out theater basically, and there were some very crazy plays that people were writing these really insane scripts in those days for uh-huh. For plays. So I was working there in theater for a while, playing music, acting bit parts, And along the way there, so some of the actors that were there were Morgan Freeman and Judd Hirsch and Danny DeVito, I think one or two others. All you know, coming up, starting their careers at the same time also. So that was a lot of fun.
That Philly scene, like, of the arts seems to be like it had a very large talent pool.
Definitely. There were, listen to your, you know, in those days, a lot of people, I would say, you know, those days made it possible. They were a catalyst for a lot of people to, you know, to find their creative sides. And, you know, because it was cool to be creative. It was cool to be a painter or a musician or, you know, or a poet or, you know, or a carpenter or whatever it was. You know, people were encouraged by the culture to do your own thing, you know, do what you know how to do, do what you love to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people were very unrestricted in that regard. Yeah. So, you know, there was me in the middle of all that. You know, I eventually was living in downtown Philly and, you know, playing in one or two bands and doing the theater gig also. And you know, eventually I went up to New York and I was performing in Greenwich Village in the city with some other people. And somewhere in the course of 1970, something else hit me in the head. You know, I started to think about myself as a Jew. I hadn't thought about myself as a Jew since my bar mitzvah. And here I am, 19 going on 20. And all of a sudden, I'm having all these serious thoughts. And just about at the same time, towards the end of 1990, I'm sorry, 1970. I'm skipping it. 1970. So my mom and my aunt were taking a trip to Israel. And I was back in Philly at this point also. I just, honestly, I'd had enough of it. So I went back to Philly. And, you know, mom and my aunt, you know, both of them, may they rest in peace, said, come with us. We're going for a bar mitzvah, a wedding. Come with us. So I said, okay, you know, change of scene. I could use it. I figure I'll go to Israel for a couple of weeks. You know, I had an offer on the table to do some demo songs of my own original stuff with an up-and-coming new record company. And I said, great. You know, I passed the audition, so to speak. And off I went to Israel. I said, I'll see you guys in a couple of weeks. And things moved very quickly from there. The inspiration was just, it was everywhere. I mean, everything you looked at, everything you touched, every person you spoke to, you know, it didn't matter, religious, non-religious. There was just a newness and a spirit to everything that you were just taken in by. You were seduced by it even. And it wasn't long after that, after traveling around a little bit, that I found myself in a yeshiva, you know, for Bali Tshuva. And I said, wow, this is so cool, you know, because, you know, my family lost a lot of people, like a lot of us in the Holocaust, you know, my parents' families and my grandparents. And, you know, I'm not sure which part of Europe your family comes from, but, you know.
My family's Hungarian, so my family, we lost a lot in the war also.
Yeah. My mother-in-law, may she rest in peace, was she was Romanian-Hungarian. There were a lot of Romanians that claimed to be Hungarians, but but anyway, it's a whole other spiel. But anyway, so yeah, I'm familiar with all that. And I grew up speaking Yiddish, by the way. It's it's my mama lotion, as we say.
Speaking Yiddish in Philly is not necessarily the first guess of that.
Yeah. I mean, look, if, you know, something that I wasn't walking around in the hippie days speaking Yiddish to people, but you know, but it was there. It sort of was the underlying foundation of Rosenblum here.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I even think in Yiddish, even to this day. It's really, it's strange. it's very strange. You know, Avram, was tusta? You know what? It's like, you know, what are you doing? You know, so I hear my parents' voice, you know, Avram. But anyway, so so all this is going on while I'm playing in rock bands and I'm writing songs and I'm traveling around and, you know, going up to New York. And so, like I said, so in January of 1971, off I go to Israel, thinking I'm going to be there just for a couple of weeks. And I end up on a kibbutz where I was sent by one of the, you know, kibbutz offices in Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
To go for ulpan, to learn Hebrew, and, you know, to get oriented in the country. And again, I only saw it as a temporary thing. But anyway, so I, on the way to that office, there was a kiosk outside the main synagogue in Tel Aviv.
Uh-huh.
And there was a woman there selling, you know, tchotchkes and Jewish things and, you know, sidurim and yarmulkes. And I picked up a yarmulke, plopped it on my head. She says, "It looks very nice on you." Right. So I said, "Okay, I'll buy it," whatever it was, 4 shekel at the time. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I went off to the kibbutz office and got to see the lady that was, interviewing people and deciding where to send them to.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, "Okay, so you want to go to a kibbutz dati?" I said, "Not necessarily."
Mm-hmm.
She says, let me repeat. "You want to go to a kibbutz dati, yes?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm not fussy. You know, it doesn't matter to me. She said, "But you are wearing a kippah." I said, "I like hats." So she sent me off to a kibbutz up in the Megiddo Valley area, somewhere near Afula, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the oldest communist kibbutzim in Israel.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously, they didn't want God coming in the front gate. So I was wearing my yarmulke. So the Minahel, the guy in charge of the ulpan, sees me there, you know, with my yarmulke,
mm-hmm.
and gets up on his tippy toes, looking up over the top of my head. You know, that's how he says, mm-hmm. "You're not going to need that here." So I didn't last long there. I was out of there in 10 days.
Yeah.
A couple of guys and me went down to Yerushalayim for a day trip. And we got into what was then, at least in the initial stages of a very profound conversation, sitting in a coffee shop at Jaffa Gate. And I asked, an existential question, like, why are we here, and why in Israel, and why Jerusalem, and,
uh-huh.
Why do they say this is the center of the universe, and, these few phrases that I'd heard, being spoken here and there by different, different people, different types. So I said, does anybody know? And one of the guys said, there's a yeshiva over about 5 minutes walk from here,
mm-hmm.
on Har Tzion, and it's like where King David is buried.
Yeah.
So they immediately got my attention, and I said, okay, can you take me over there? So, that was the beginning. I went over there and I met some of the guys. I met Rabbi Goldstein, Zichrono Livracha, our Rosh Yeshiva. And, but I had my guitar with me. And, everywhere that Rosenblum went, the guitar was sure to go. So, it was just, so as my experiences, started to change, as my consciousness of myself as a Jew is, began to do some learning and, hear some Busser Schmoozes and, the package started to unravel a bit, mm-hmm. the old ways and the old thoughts made room, just kind of I pushed them out of the way and I made room for thinking like a Jew, thinking like a Torah Jew.
Yeah. Was there a music scene at the yeshiva already going on? Like, there was already people that were playing and stuff like that, or that kind of took off later?
It took off, the following year, really, in the following 2 years. I was at the center of it at the time, and a bunch of other guys came into the yeshiva that were also talented people. And so little by little, we ended up with a 15-piece band,
uh-huh.
of different people. It was like a musical troupe more than a band.
Uh-huh.
And we debuted in a place called Beit Ha'am in Yerushalayim. That was uh-huh. the scene of the Eichmann trials way, way, way many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And a nice little theater. And, we were getting popular by 1975. A lot of people used to come up to just hear us jam on Saturday nights after Shabbos. And so we debuted as a 15-man musical troupe.
Uh-huh.
And it was a smashing success. And people were talking about us. The word got out. The word got around the world, really.
Yeah.
So in due time, by sometime in 1976, you know, later in that year, I had whittled down, the 15-man troupe down into a 5 or 6-piece band.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people split off doing their own thing at the same time. So that was the origin of Diaspora Yeshiva Band.
Why did you guys go with the Diaspora Yeshiva Band? Why was that the choice of, let's call the band this?
It's a good question, and very few people ask it, and I'm happy you did ask it. The answer is, it was a real name. Uh-huh. It wasn't just some, fluffy, here they are, the King David's Band or something like that.
Uh-huh.
We were a band and we were in the yeshiva. So I saw it as a very good thing. And I figured that, it's even if it sounds a little klutzy, people are going to remember it.
Uh-huh.
So, by the way, there was a band in the 60s and 70s known as The Band.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you're familiar with them.
I'm not.
They gained their popularity back in the mid 60s by being Bob Dylan's backup band. They were originally from Arkansas and Toronto, and they were a great band. So they put out their own albums starting in 1968. So the band was like my all-time favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Wow, cool. So it'll be the Diaspora Yeshiva Band." Right?
Yeah.
So that's how it really came about. And
fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, look, it's like, I don't know, dude, when colleges have their, marching bands, do they give them names? Oh, I think they do sometimes,
I think some do, it kind of, but I feel like a lot of times it takes on, like, the university's nickname. Like, it won't be, like, a completely something from nothing. It'll be it'll be rooted in something, which I guess is what you guys
the Tigers said. Or the Elephant Marching Band or something like that.
Yeah.
But
that makes sense. When you guys were jamming, were you guys also already writing songs at that time, or it's when you guys whittled down to the five of you that you guys really were more writing versus playing? Like, how did that develop? Like, what were you guys, when you guys were writing, what was your process to create the music you were creating?
So those of us that contributed the original songs to the band, and there were a few of us, some people that we're writing songs and then left the band to go back to America to do other things. One of them is a very, very dear friend of mine all these years, Rabbi Moshe Shur. He wrote a couple of the songs that stayed with the band. One of them was Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha, well-known niggin. Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha, Ivdu Es Hashem B'Simcha, Bo Lefan Lef Birnana, Lefan Lef Birnana. So that's a Moshe Shur tune. And also the big rocker that we adapted into, it started out as a folk song, but it ended up being like a major anthem, Jewish rocker, called Hafachta Mispidi, You Brought Me Up.
Yeah.
And that was covered, that's been covered by dozens of bands over the years.
What does it feel like to have your songs covered? Is that like an honor? Like, what does that feel like as a musician?
Yeah, I mean, look, I kind of like being in the position of being an altar rocker, as we say.
Uh-huh.
It's cool. It's very cool. People, that people like our music, that other musicians and other bands want to play some of the stuff that we popularized. I mean, it's a great feeling. What's even a greater feeling is just the fact that, we spawned, like hundreds of bands and performers, and we really made, original music, and, not the mainstream Jewish music. We really made the creative side, the individualistic side, very popular, made it much easier for a lot of people to then, kind of follow in our footsteps and write their own Jewish rock or Jewish folk rock or whatever it might have been. This, by the way, all this is happening at the same time. Of course, Shlomo Carlbach, was serenading the world and getting everybody to sing and jump up and down and dance. He was an incredible person. So his influences were out there too, even though we were not a Carlbachian band per se, but we did a couple of his tunes on some of our albums and, performed in as part of our jamming. So it was just, it was an incredible musical world. At the same time, things were going on in Brooklyn. A lot of people that also became friends of mine later were 770. They were Lubavitch musicians, Bali Tshuva also.
Uh-huh.
And so there was a thriving scene going on, or starting at least, in Brooklyn at the time also, when we were doing our thing on Hartzion. We were fortunate in that we were invited to perform in the Israel Hasidic Song Festival, which was a real big deal, you know, back in the 70s, going into the mid-80s.
Yeah.
And there was a song that I co-wrote called Hu Yiftach Libenu, that I, you know, kind of rewrote and adapted to the style that they needed in the Hasidic Festival. Yeah. And so we performed as... three vocalists and four guys sitting in with the band, with the orchestra rather, and we won first prize that year. You know, it was like amazing. You know,
which year was that?
That was 1977.
Uh-huh.
Right. Sounds like ancient history to you, right? But so then we did it again the following year. We came back with a song that someone else wrote, an outside songwriter. With a song called Malchutcha, or Malchutcha. Malchutcha, Malchutcha Olamim, Shaftecha, B'chol Devedor. So that, you know, that song is still around. You still hear it on Simchas Torah, or you hear it played at weddings occasionally here and there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we made our mark. We, you know, we left an impression, and, you know, we go from there.
Yeah, you were saying that like you had some people sitting in on those shows. Was Artemis Pyle, who was in Lynyrd Skynyrd, one of those people? I know he sat in with the band at some point.
So Artemis, you know, the drummer for Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, had been through a, you know, really heavy experience. You know, some of his band members were killed in a plane crash.
Yeah.
He was not on that plane, so he, you know, he's a surviving member of that band. And he had a buddy that actually I think was a roadie for him, a Jewish guy, that ended up on Hartzion also. And so he had invited Artemis, you know, post that whole thing, to come to Hartzion to chill out, you know, to kind of, you know, refresh himself after all that experience. Artemis is not a Jewish person, but, you know, but he was a spiritual-minded guy. And so, but this all happened after the era of the original band. You know, this happened sometime, I think, 82, 83, 84, somewhere in that period.
Did he play with you guys a lot? Was that just like a little bit?
Well, he wasn't performing with me. I'm saying that he came later and he performed with some of the, you know, some of the other people that were, you know, forming a, you know, a diaspora yeshiva band at that time.
2.0, I guess.
Well, listen, we, you know, we had left the yeshiva. The band basically gradually, we went, you know, off to do other things over time. For a while, we were performing at the NCSY Center, which at that in those days was on Strauss Street, if you know Yerushalayim at all. So it was a, you know, smaller place than what they have now, and we were performing under a different name for a couple of years under the name Selo, you know, Samach Lamed Hey, which means which is really an acronym for Sav, go back Lamala to the beginning, Hashar, to the song conductor of the group of Levium. So it's basically take it from the top. So that's, so we adopted that name for a couple of years. And then it was pretty much the end of the era by 1983. And actually, I'm sorry, 1986, really, that was the end of the era.
What was that like? I know, like, now Jewish concerts aren't so much of a thing, but, like, then that was, like, the thing. What were those kind of experiences like, playing bigger, like Jewish concerts and things like that over that time frame?
Well, listen, playing for any big audience is exciting and thrilling. You know, it doesn't matter what you do, what you represent, you know, and what you know, what you're espousing. It's you know, when you have a crowd and you give it your best, you know, you really reach out to a group of people, and you, and by the end of the evening, you know, you're drenched in sweat because you you gave it your best shot. You wanted to get something across to the people.
Yeah.
So big crowds are, you know, what I love the most. But we had more than just you know, the idea of getting people to jump up and down.
Yeah.
We had a message, and the message was living a Torah life is where it's at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we celebrated, you know, the fact that, you know, we're Jews, that that our Judaism is based in Torah, and you know, we just tried to make people feel good about, you know, about themselves as Jews.
Yeah.
Subsequently, we were able to, you know, to influence some people that became Bali Tshuva, you know, and even, you know, pick themselves up from America, you know, and move to Israel. So we had you know, a hashpah, we had an influence on people And that's what we wanted. That was the purpose of the band, was to reach out to Klal Yisrael, and with the kind of music that people that didn't grow up observant, who were not into Jewish wedding music, so they heard us doing music that sounded an awful lot like the stuff that they'd grown up on also. That's really what the whole thing was really all about.
It's interesting, especially like you were talking earlier about like Carl Bach doing his style, and you had the people in Crown Heights who were doing their style, and what you guys were doing also. It kind of, the way you were describing it almost describes kind of the same way that I feel like the music of the 60s and 70s in general kind of had that kind of like different aspects to it, but within that same like sphere stylistically, like that rock and roll era of that time.
Yes and no. Yes, in that, we were all products of the 60s, the dynamics, the creative dynamics of, the 1960s and early 70s. But there were so many different bands, and there were so many different styles of music, that were coming into the world, into the world, or at least being discovered by that generation. Mm-hmm. And so we all kind of, drifted into our own things. I mean, yeah. There was a group in Crown Heights called Rava Behemna. Uh-huh. They were a little bit more Sephardic oriented, in their rhythmic stuff. Yossi Pimenta, blessed memory, and his brother Avi, were incredible. Yeah, I mean, Yossi was an incredible, incredible guitarist. His brother, a great flute player. They were a duo. They were influenced by jazz, and they were influenced, by flute, kind of, flute and hybrid, kind of rock and roll and jazz. And, so there were different influences on us depending on, just whatever it was. I mean, it just so happened that there were enough influences to go around. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. What were your, at that time, what were your influences? Like you mentioned the band earlier, but were there other musical influences that really influenced your music that you create?
So, look, my personal favorites in those days were the band, as I mentioned. I love the Beatles, the harmonies that I love to get together with friends and sing were usually, Beatle-type harmonies. Uh-huh. There was Bob Dylan, who had, who inspired a lot of people to really dig down deep and to, find lyrics that were meaningful, because he's a master poet, and everybody wanted to be Bob Dylan,
Yeah.
So, those were just some of the influences. There were some folk music people that I used to listen to, but I'll tell you something. My own personal taste in music also includes musical theater. I like Broadway shows. I like music that goes with dialogue, that goes with the script. I've always been attracted to that also. So maybe in some ways, the kind of English lyrics that I write, have a bit of that in them, trying to, create some imagery that to me is a little bit, harkens back to when the musical theater was really something.
Are there any plays that speak to you in particular?
Well, there was a famous show, in the 70s called Hair, mm-hmm. which was basically a celebration of the whole hippie thing at the time.
Yeah.
And so they had some great songs, I'm Gonna Live Forever, and some beautiful stuff. So I like that. I like when people staged, musical events, like I say, with a script and with a theme, and especially when it was something that people could relate to. It was a product of its time. It wasn't like, mm-hmm. Doing the 13th iteration of Bye Bye Birdie, or it was new, it was fresh, it was happening.
We touch a lot on the hippie movement of the 60s and stuff like that, and your musical influences. So I know you went to Woodstock. What was that experience like as a whole? And like, was there any particular act that stood out to you?
Well, the whole concert started out. I mean, firstly, it was just chaos. I mean, nothing violent happened, but it was totally chaotic because there was a traffic jam going down the Route 17B, mm-hmm. From the Monticello area where that festival took place. It was a 35 mile, 40 mile traffic jam, and the entertainers couldn't get there. Mm-hmm. You know, their trucks, buses, whatever it was, limos, couldn't get there, and they had to be flown in by helicopters. So the whole schedule of the whole event was just like went out the window. Mm-hmm. And so did, you know, ticket collecting. I mean, basically the fences came down after about 50,000 people, and that was it. And they declared it a free concert. So, you know, 500,000 people later.
Yeah.
But some of my favorite people were there, and the show opened with a gentleman named Richie Havens, who was very, very well known. Actually, he was even an icon then, you know, the folk music era, who just played an incredible acoustic guitar with these driving rhythms. And
yeah.
So he ended up opening up the show. So, you know, it's worth it to go back and watch the movie. But so Richie Havens was a wonderful solo performer that I used to feel something from. My group, The Band, performed there. That was one of their debut performances. Uh-huh. As The Band. They used to be called The Hawks. Uh-huh. when they backed up another performer named Ronnie Hawkins. And so The Band was there. Ravi Shankar, you know, if you ever heard of him, he was an Indian sitar player. You know what a sitar is?
I do not.
It's this long and at the bottom, you know, bulbous, you know, what do they call that? It's a gourd. It's, the gourd is the sound box down at the bottom.
Yeah. I feel like I've seen something like, I've probably seen it before.
And it goes, so anyway, so it's fretted in a way, but it's like, you know, up and down. Mm-hmm. The neck. And Ravi Shankar was a big influence on George Harrison from the Beatles.
Uh-huh.
So there was a song called Norwegian Wood on the Beatles' Rubber Soul album that has a sitar solo in it. So if you get a chance to listen to that, you'll hear what it sounds like. So, you know, I mean, look, it was everything, you know. It was, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash, they performed there also, I think, as one of their earliest concerts. So, you know, these were, you know, they all became it for me. These were the iconic bands and performers and people and that, you know, that I was paying close attention to, and their influences were very strong on me. So that when I eventually became a BT rocker. You know, a lot of that came out in me, and uh-huh. you can hear it in, you know, the earliest Diaspora Yeshiva Band records, starting from 1976. So, that was my thing. Other guys in the band, you know, one was a bluegrass expert, you know, and that's Bensiel Solomon, and another guy played jazz saxophone, and our drummer used to play in Holiday Inn bands, you know, and at one time, and Ruby Harris, incredible hot fiddle player. He's a violinist, mm-hmm. and also plays mandolin and guitar and harmonica. He's just like one of these, you know, amazing, you know, handy guys, you know. And so everybody had their influences. And when the band came together as the band leader, the way I like to run a band is I let everybody be themselves. See, the idea was we were all very adept players. So the idea was to bring out everybody's influences and make it, you know, one whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it worked. It's not like, you know, I wasn't handing out pieces of paper and saying, here, follow this chart and follow this lead sheet and whatever it is. The whole idea was that we were all very individualistic, you know, and it came together like Klal Yisrael comes together, you know, where everybody's different. And eventually, you know, eventually we all become, you know, one thing, you know, with a great synergy. So that was our band.
Yeah. As you called yourself a BT rocker, and you mentioned also, like, again, like the Chabad community also had a lot of that music also was coming from Bali Tshuva, people who were coming back to Judaism. Why do you think that's where, I feel like a lot of the innovation in Jewish music comes from the Bali Tshuva community. Either it's now with, there's hip-hop acts now that are kind of doing that, or you had, in your generation, rock and roll that was influencing it. Why is that where that influence comes from?
Look, I think that we live in a culture that, unless you're living a very cloistered kind of life, or, you know, or a very insular, you know, kind of community, like some of the, you know, what we call the ultra-Orthodox, although I don't like to put them in a box, but bottom line is they, you know, their communities are kind of closed off from, you know, from the secular world. You know, these days, I don't think they were wrong, given everything that's going on the street today. But, you know, the idea was that, you know, we grew up in a world of, you know, lots of different things going on at the same time. And the music of, you know, of the, you know, the days that I was, you know, that I was, you know, growing up, and everybody, you know, had their favorite kind of music. And I think that once we broke open that door, that Jewish music didn't have to sound like, you know, your father's or grandfather's, you know, wedding and bar mitzvah music. So, you know, with clarinets and, you know, with the guitar, electric guitar took the place of the clarinet. And, you know, so, you know, and all the younger, even the, you know, the kids that were from birth, so to speak, another one of those terms that's really weird, but anyway, but even, even, you know, the guys that came from traditional homes that loved music, you know, they also, they picked up on the influences of, you know, pop and you know, rock music. And because we had made it cool already, so it made it, you know, it facilitated that for them. It made it, you know, the door was open. They could finally play the music that they liked, that they used to listen to in their dormitories underneath pillows, you know, so that the, you know, the mashgiach, the yeshiva, wouldn't hear it, you know. So, you know, so it changed. It, it was no longer out of bounds, so to speak. It was no longer treif. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, we talked about your influences, but why do you, like, I personally, like, rock speaks more to me than, let's say, pop, but it seems like Jewish music, kind of, at least definitely modern Jewish music, is very pop-centered. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the same way that, you know, most pop music resonates with most people. It's created to kind of, you know, cover a lot of ground, you know, and be accessible and acceptable, you know, to the largest audiences. It's, you know, it's pretty well thought through. Not everybody likes a writer like Bob Dylan or something, or Neil Young, or, you know, not everybody wants music that's so, you know, so heady and, you know, and poetic. And pop music in every culture is, you know, serving the same purpose for the most part. It's just, you know, it's there to entertain and distract, I guess, you know. So, you know, little by little, as the culture changed and as the styles of pop music changed, you know, eventually you ended up with a lot of electronic music for many years. Disco had a, you know, had a very strong influence on Hasidic music and on wedding music. It was always a disco beat. It was, you know, that was underlying, you know, the music. And then eventually went to electronica, as we say, you know, with that heavy bass drum, electronic driving beat, which, you know, and then at the same time, you know, the influences of rap music, you know, started to come into Jewish music. And, you know, a lot of people found ways to use rap, you know, to get a Jewish thing across, you know, and, you know, look, anything that's, to me, anything that's well done, you know, that's done thoughtfully and it's done with, you know, with, you know, with, you know, more than thought, but, you know, where the people have talent to pick up on the styles of music that have creeped into our culture, seeped into our culture, I should say. So, you know, it's all good. Look, personally, I don't like a lot of the electronic, heavy beat, you know, stuff that's, you know, that's being, you know, being played and is very popular right now. But that's, you know, you could say I'm just an alto rocker, as I said before. So
let's transition, I guess, just an interesting thought. You've performed with, like, a lot of people over the years. Are there any well-known or, like, secular artists that you've performed with?
So, you know, it would go back to my musical theater days in you know, in Philly. Where I worked with some people that, you know, eventually became, you know, very well known. I was part of a band with my childhood friend Frank Stallone, who's Sylvester, you know, Rocky's younger brother. You know, we know each other since we're 12 years old, and we're still good friends to this very day. He's, you know, he's been out in L.A., Hollywood, you know, creating his own career while his brother, like, skyrocketed to a mega, mega, mega stardom. So Frank and I are to this day very good friends. There were a couple other people. Michael Bacon, I don't know if you know that name, but his brother is the actor Kevin Bacon. So Michael and I did some of that musical theater stuff that that I'd mentioned. Who else did I know? Yeah, so in Valentine, so after I left the band and went off to Israel, so there was a young guitarist that joined the band for a while and played with Frank named John Oates. And if you've heard of Hall & Oates.
I have heard of Hall & Oates.
So John Oates took my spot in Valentine. I'm mm-hmm. know, I was lead guitar player, and John Oates is a pretty good guitar player. So, you know, there were people I crossed paths with along the way, you know, in Greenwich Village, but not everybody became a big name.
Like in Greenwich Village at the time, were there any people that became big name acts?
I don't know. I'm sure there are. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of, again, there were a lot of different strains of music going on. There was a place called the Village Gate, which was a big jazz center. But also, you know, for some, you know, some rock bands, you know, performed there too. The last band I had in America before I went to Israel was called Freehand, which mm-hmm. was a term that came from a Bob Dylan song called Mr. Tambourine Man. And there's a line in there, to dance beneath the diamond sky with one hand waving free. It was, you know, an image of just spacing out, you know, and going with nature and just, you know, so I named the band Freehand at the time. So, and we played at that Village Gate and we opened up, we were the opening act for a large jazz and vocal band. And some of the people in that band, there were two brothers named the Brecker brothers, mm-hmm. Incredible horn players. They went off into big stardom. So I'm sure there were a lot more, but I didn't necessarily always personally cross paths.
Yeah. You've talked about in the past, say, meeting Tom Petty in Israel.
That was a really, really interesting, meeting. A friend of mine, Dave Ehrlich, was one of the associate producers on the Israel side. Mm-hmm. He's a videographer, and he and his wife are actually in the cookie business these days. If you ever saw ads for Gilly's Goodies, so that's them. But anyway, so Dave was working as an associate producer, and the producers from the States who were following Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers around in Europe and other places were looking for some, you know, Israeli acts that they could include in an MTV production. Mm-hmm. Dave brought us up. So it was us and I believe the other act that was in there was a well-known Israeli singer-songwriter, Shalom Chanoch, I believe was his name. Mm-hmm. Very, very well-known. They called him the Bob Dylan of Israel. So you know, he's in that video, we're in that video, and we're interviewed, and we're talking about music and the different things that, that Diaspora Yeshiva band, was able to, you know, to get across to people. And that made it to MTV. And so what was cool about that was I was, the next day, so I was in the old city. I used to be the executive director of Heritage House, which was Mayor Schuster's, one of his outreach centers, mm-hmm. if anybody knows that name out there. You know, may his name be for a blessing. Mayor Schuster was one of the big, big holy men and kiruv guys in Yerushalayim in those days. I mean, he picked up hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of Jewish kids that were just, you know, wandering through with their backpacks. And he would just walk up and say, are you Jewish? Mm-hmm. Anybody? He was a tzaddik. So yeah, anyway, so I was running mayor's operation for a while, and I was in the old city that next day after we'd done some jamming for this for that show. Mm-hmm. And I got a call that Tom Petty and his entourage were, you know, coming down in the old city, and they would be there very shortly. I said great. So then I was told to meet them down by the Kotel. Mm-hmm. So that's where the opportunity to schmooze and to tell Tom Petty, you know, that up on Harabayat, you know, that Dome of the Rock, well, that rock is the foundation stone of the universe, right? Mm-hmm. And Tom was like, wow. It was like he'd never been hit with that type of information before in his life. Mm-hmm. And he was like really struck by it. And the video shows him walking away with another major entertainer named Roger McGuinn, who had a group called the Byrds, BYRDS. They did a lot of Dylan stuff also back in the day, but they had their own style of doing it. Great band, great band. So he and Roger McGuinn are walking away, and he says to Roger, and they picked it up on my pretty wild rap. Right? So, you know, and then a few seconds later, when they're walking away from the Kotel Plaza, like down towards Dungate, Shar Ashbot, which is down the hill as you walk away from the Kotel. So they pick up again where he's saying, you know, I had 10 years of Sunday schooling, and I learned more in 5 minutes from that guy than I ever got from any of that.
Yeah.
So I took that as a great compliment. It's in, you know, it's in the world. It's on YouTube. You can look up a Rosenblum Petty, you know, and you'll find my 2 minutes of major stardom. And what was even cooler was I was traveling. I was in an airport, you know, and some young kid, a non-Jewish kid, you know, sees me and says, I saw you on MTV with Tom Petty. So, you know, I was like, wow. Yeah. You know, it's like, it was nice to get the recognition.
Yeah, it's interesting. We were talking both about bands you were in growing up, being in diaspora, and like the different genres that includes. Do you see room for Jewish music to cross into the mainstream? Just as obviously, mainstream music kind of made its way into Jewish music. Do you think there's room for that to influence to go in the reverse?
I'm not sure. You know, the world by and large is not Jewish. Right? And you know, they know even more about, you know, pop music and country music and, you know, and rock music. You have a lot of, you know, Christian rock and roll that's, you know, that's a huge industry.
Yeah.
Coming out of, you know, places like Nashville. Where, you know, there are people that, you know, grew up in churches and Sunday school, eventually, you know, became, you know, country rock stars, whatever it was. And so their roots are in usually white gospel, although, you know, some black gospel too.
Their roots are in faith, which is...
Yeah. So you hear a lot of that in the lyrics of country music. You know, they're not bashful about, yeah, I don't want the church this Sunday and, you know, whatever it is. You know, so they're, you know, they're pretty upfront, you know, about who they are. And so, you know, there's a huge industry of music, you know, that has the influences and inspiration that, you know, to speak to that, you know, world, and it's a big world. So about Jewish music crossing over, well, there are some artists that have crossed over instrumentally, like Andy Statman, if you know who he is, an incredible, you know, mandolin player and clarinetist that performs along with some, you know, major bluegrass musicians that took an interest in him. They're you know, very pro-faith type people, and very pro-Israel. So they, you know, they took a love really to Andy. So there are mostly, I'd say most of them are instrumental musicians, not necessarily singer-songwriters. Because the messages for the non-Jewish world are, you know, they're out there already. They don't need, you know, they don't need us to, you know, to sing about, you know, learning Torah and you know, sitting in the base of Medrash or whatever, you know, the themes are. That's not of interest to them. You know, we're not of their culture. You know, we imitate their culture. We often do it quite well. You know, if you think back for a second to talk about imitating, you know, most of what we called traditional Jewish music was really, you know, music from Poland or music from Russia. You know, they had their influences then because that was the pop music, you know, of that era, you know, the old, you know, and the old Yiddish stuff. You know, you listen to it and you realize, you know, this is a Russian melody and that's a Hungarian melody. And that's, you know, you see how, you know, we've always adapted or adopted really the styles of music of the cultures around us, and but they don't need our messages. They're not looking for our messages. I mean, Matisyahu managed to cross over. I mean, but he started out as a very talented, you know, Jamaican type rapper. When he became a Bali Tshuva, so people accepted him in the non-Jewish world. You know, with his long beard and with his sisters hanging out, but he himself personally, you know, went through some sort of a transition and kind of moved away from that. I'm trying to remember the Alex Clare, who's a British pop star. So I know I've met Alex, and today he's an incredibly frum guy, and he still performs, you know, for you know, audiences of all sorts, non-Jewish audiences, especially in Europe. Because, you know, he writes songs that are not overtly, you know, a sales pitch for, you know, for Yiddishkeit. You know, he has some great material, and people love the way he performs. So then there's Nisim Black, who's really a phenomena. Mm-hmm. You know, who came in from the world of rap, became a convert to Judaism. He's a Breslover Chassid, you know, he manages to get people's attention because he's a force. You know, he's just a force. He gets out there and he's like, you know, the heavyweight champion of the world, you know, in the way he, you know, delivers his rap music. So there are a couple, you know, that have the potential. And going back to Yossi Pimenta for a second, I mean, Yossi's guitar playing was world class. Mm-hmm. You know, he could go toe to toe, you know, with pretty much any of them in his day. You know, he could jam with Carlos Santana, mm-hmm. you know, and probably show Santana a couple of things because his Yossi's influences were very authentic also.
Mm-hmm. Are there any acts that, like, if you would tell somebody who's more in the Jewish world, like, check this out, this is something that you should see, like, more up-and-coming or just, like, intriguing artists to keep an eye out for?
I haven't stayed up on it that much, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. What I do is, we have, you know, a bunch of grandchildren, thank God, and, you know, some of them are very musical, and, you know, I try to get together with them and give them lessons or just some pointers, and, you know, and I play some of the old stuff for them, and then they play some of the stuff that they like, you know, for me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's an exchange of ideas between me and my grandkids that's actually quite astounding. You know, I can't believe... you know, that after, you know, Ani Keben Shivim Shana, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I hit a milestone and my grandkids, you know, are getting into the kind of music that, you know, that I loved when I was a kid. So, yeah. You know, I show them where it's at, you know, with, you know, 60s and 70s music, and they turn me on to their world.
Are you still making music these days? Obviously, we're in your studio. You have your guitars up on the wall. Are you still making and writing?
I've been writing, you know, I've got a bunch of little ideas, you know, the little sparks that need to be fanned, so to speak, and hopefully they'll turn into full-blown songs. You know, I try to record on my little hand recorder. Yeah. You know, anytime an idea goes through my head, just to hold on to it. And eventually, you know, I try to produce, you know, a well-developed demo down here in my studio. It's not a full-blown, you know, type of final product studio, mm-hmm. but it's where I experiment with a lot of different things.
I'm going to fan out myself here for a second. There are two moments that from you guys' music that really sit with me, which is growing up like in Atlanta, so we'd always drive up to New York and things like that. So I still remember, I think it's a white cassette. I could be wrong, but one of your cassettes, I think it was even the first song on this, on maybe side B, but Es Hashem.
Es Hashem HaMavorach.
You're introducing the band. It has like this whole like very...
Uncle Simcha, Uncle Gedalia, and Uncle Eitan in the booth. That whole shit.
Yep. Exactly. That sits with me. Like I remember like just hearing that on drives.
That was a fun tune. It just, you know, we created that tune in the studio. You know, we just wrote down the chord changes that we wanted, the transitions that we wanted, and everybody just had a good time with it. And that whole introduction was just, you know, it was just, I was just ad-libbing it,
yeah.
You know, at the time, you know, because, and part of it was a little bit of a spoof on Uncle Moishi, uh-huh. You know, so it was Uncle Avram and Uncle Gedalia and Uncle Ruby and Uncle Simcha, and, you know, so we, that's kind of where that was coming from.
Yeah.
But even though I became a fan of Uncle Moishi eventually, because everybody, all my kids were listening to it, so.
Yeah. The other thing that's interesting to me is, on Pesach, we use your niggun for Lois Avoseinu when we're going through the Haggadah.
Yeah, it's a great melody. It was that's one that was written by my brother-in-law, a guy named Yossel Rosenzweig. When he went off from the yeshiva, and he and I had been performing that song in a duo for a while, mm-hmm. so that you know I you know, redid it so it would work in a band style.
Yeah.
If you look at the videos that are on YouTube of the 2014 Hask concert, which was, I think, their 27th concert. So our little set, the middle tune is Lois Avoseinu. And I decided on that song instead of something like Tzaddik or one of the other ones is the middle tune, because you have to watch Gedalia Goldstein on the drums in that video. Uh-huh. You know, firstly, he's got a long, you know, he's got a long white beard. He's Lubavitch, you know, so his, you know, beard is very, very there, uh-huh. You know, and we rented him a set of white drums. So it looked incredible, you know, and he's just like sparkling. The spotlight was hitting him, and it's just, you know, everybody said, he looks like a Rosh Hashiva, but look at him, look at the way he plays. Right? So, you know, that was the whole point of doing that middle song. But we had some great instrumental stuff going on in there too. You should look that one up. Everybody, look that one up. It's on YouTube.
I definitely will. One last thing, which I think is interesting, is I guess where do you see the role of music in Kirov in general? I don't know about now, but definitely in the 70s and the 80s, that seemed to play a very big role in the Kirov movement.
Look, if anything, as we were saying earlier, Od Mosif V'Holech, I think that we have opened ourselves up and developed a lot of different forms of expression in the Jewish world that include some very, very well-developed music, some well-developed art and painters. I think that the role is more than just a role. It's kind of there in essence, you know, the you know, it says, we say Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, right? Uh-huh. So, you know, how do you make people b'simcha? So you have music, and you get people up and dancing or just singing, and you know, it opens up the heart. So if anything, you know, it's beyond therapeutic. It's essential to the Jewish soul to be able to express itself through music. You know, music is unique to human beings, and you know, and the Torah is unique to us, and so, you know, being able to, you know, to bring it all together is quite something. So it's only going to get stronger and stronger until Mashiach comes.
Amen. Thank you again. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
You know, I hope that, you know, the craziness in the world eventually subsides. I think we're all still reeling from what's going on outside, you know, unfortunately with this virus. And you know, I've lost some friends. I know other people, of course, have you know, but you know, I think it's time to take a sane look at the world, and I hope that the Klal Yisrael will not fall prey to a lot of the insanity that's going on out there. You know, we need every Jewish neshama, every Yiddish neshama. We need them to come back home, and to not get hung up along the way on other isms that aren't Judaism.
Thank you so much again. I really, really appreciate you taking the time tonight.
It was my great pleasure. Thanks for reaching out to me.
Pleasure.
Peace.
Peace. Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did. For more conversations like the one you just heard, please follow us on Instagram at OurFaithThrough, THRU, music, and subscribe in your favorite podcasting app. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.